coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borakthung, Earthlets, and welcome to another episode of the 2080 Thrillcast. I am Molchar, your host, as we take another aural dip into the great pool that is the galaxy's greatest comic. It's wonderful to be joined this week by Tharg's minion, Matt Smith. He's here to talk a little bit about Prog 2000. Yes, after all these years, 2080 is finally at its 2000th issue, which will be out at the end of September. And we're going to talk to Matt in a second about the Gafflebet lineup that we have, with some big old names returning to the pages of the Galaxy's Greatest Comic for the first time in many years. And after that, we're going to be talking to writer Dan Abnett and artist Phil Winslade about Lawless, which is their Judge Marshall series running in the Judge Red magazine, which has a double-length episode in this month's Judge Red magazine. So make sure you pick that up after listening to a great little chat with Dan and Phil. Matt.
Hello.
Welcome back to the 2080 Thrill Cast. As I said at the beginning, we are coming up to Prog 2000, which I know many Earthlets are excitedly waiting for. Tell us a little bit about the big names who are returning to 2080 for this issue.
Right, well, yes, kind of always a daunting prospect to try and put together a milestone issue, and doubly so when you've done quite a few of them over the last 15 years. So I've kind of, you know, done the 25th anniversary and the 30th anniversary and the 35th anniversary. It's always a task trying to come up with something, I think, new for a new big issue. But Prog 2000, I thought I would try to capture certain periods of 2000 AD over the last nearly 40 years. So so for Dread, obviously I went to John and Carlos as the creators of the character. And then I tried to get a couple of 80s stories in there. So we've got a Rogue Trooper story by Gordon Rennie and Richard Elson, and also a brand new Nemesis the Warlock story by Pat and Kevin.
Wow.
Which I was very pleased that Kevin agreed to come back and do a new one. And he's done phenomenal work. It's a lovely looking six-pager.
Brilliant.
Not a flashback story, but actually set after the end of the end of book 10.
So, oh wow! Okay.
So the story continues.
And we've also got a Tharg story, which dips in and out through the course of the issue, haven't we?
Yeah, that was something I decided to add as a little wrinkle, which is that each story is introduced by a kind of one page Tharg interlude. So basically, the setup is that Tharg is basically taking you through the history of 2000 AD by going through these little doors that take you into the bubble universes that that each story exists in.
Sure.
And also, by having these one pages, it meant I could ask some artists who wouldn't necessarily be able to commit to a full length story to be able to draw one page. So we've got one pages from Brian Bolland, Mick McMahon, Dave Gibbons, and Robin Smith, Boo Cook, and Colin McNeil.
That's a hell of a lineup.
Yeah. I mean, it's Brian's first interior strip page for 2000 AD since about 1988, something like that. Since he drew the Dread End, which apparently should have got in Prog 500, but didn't, and ended up in an annual.
Right.
But that's the last interior work he's drawn for 2000 AD.
Right. How did you convince him to do that?
I just asked him, and he said, "I think I could do a page." He's done it.
Fantastic. I mean, as you said, this is a landmark issue of several that you've done over your time as editor. When you became editor 2080, did it ever cross your mind that you would still be here for such a landmark issue? I mean, this is the biggie, really,
no,
isn't it?
I never kind of foresee how long I was going to be here for. Mm. And you never kind of imagine what state the comic's going to be in by the time it rolls around to this kind of landmark issue, and you try and put off, to be honest, in your head what you're going to do for that. Because, you know, for so long, 2000, you put off what it was going to be called in the year 2000, mm. possibly hoping it wouldn't have to answer that question. this was something that I only started really thinking about at the beginning of this year, really.
Right.
But yeah, I think it's a great looking issue. Mm. Should also mention a couple of the other things that are in it as well. There's Sinister Dexter Story by Dan and Mark Sexton, mm-hmm. and start of a new series, because I thought, well, we don't want to be too relying on the nostalgia, so we'll start a brand new series, and this one's by Peter Milligan and Rufus Daiglow, called Counterfeit Girl, mm. which is sort of ID theft, cyberpunky type thriller.
Okay.
And there's a Anderson story as well by Alan Grant and David Roach. It's a good looking lineup.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And in terms of saying to people who, but elapsed readers or have never picked up 2000 AD, maybe curious about Prog 2000, you mentioned a lot of legacy characters there. You've mentioned mm-hmm. a lot of old school creators, but there's something in there for everybody. You don't necessarily have to have read these strips all the way back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Oh no! I mean, they're perfectly easy to catch up on. Mm. And one thing it seems to have seen from the interest and success of the summer specials, which are completely self-contained. You know, you don't need to know anything about the backstory of the characters. You just read and enjoy the one-off stories in those. Is that that seems to be something that people pick up on and enjoy. Mm. So yeah, Prog 2000 is a great one to pick up and enjoy in its own right.
Mm. Of course, we've also got some lovely covers for this issue. Do you want to tell us a bit about those?
Yeah, so we've got three variant covers on this issue. 2000 is not one that we go into variant covers on a regular basis, mm. but this was a special issue that we decided to push the boat out. So we've got two variant covers for the new standard edition, which would be the one you can pick up in newsagents and corner shops. One by Cliff Robinson, which is a lovely wraparound of Tharg on a space spinner, and then there's one by Chris Burnham. So there's those, and then there's also the Diamond exclusive, which is only going to be available from comic stores, which is another wraparound from this by Glenn Fabry. Various characters all gathering around Tharg bursting out of a birthday cake. it's a real collector's edition.
Sure.
that you should really track down.
Regular readers of the Judge Dredd mega zine will be well aware of Lawless, the Dredd World series by Dan Abnett and Phil Winslade, which sees Judge Marshal Meta Lawson trying to bring the law to the town of Badrock on one of Megacity One's colonies in outer space. Calling it a Dredd World series kind of does it a disservice, because it's this wonderful little bubble of its own world where lots of rules are broken, both in terms of what you expect from a Judge Dredd World series, but also what Phil and Dan are doing character-wise with the lead character and the supporting characters. And it's all great. It's a personal favourite of mine. And in this month's Judge Dredd magazine, we have a double-length episode, which, as you'll hear from Dan and Phil in a moment, is an absolute corker. So make sure that you catch up on Lawless. Let's get straight into chatting to Dan and Phil about Lawless, how they work together, and what's coming up for Judge Meta Lawson. Guys, welcome to the Thrillcast. Dan, you've been with us before, but Phil, this is your first time, isn't it?
Yeah, I think possibly.
Yes. So we'll try and be gentle. We're here to talk about Lawless, which is wrapping up with a double episode in the next magazine. So let's go back to the very beginning. Dan, tell us a little bit about the genesis of Lawless.
Sort of complex and murky, I guess. having written Insurrection for three books in the magazine and enjoyed doing that very much, the sort of colonial aspect of the Dread universe that I'd extended there appealed to me very much, and I thought there were stories to tell there, sort of space westerns essentially. And it's something I sort of kicked around, came up with an idea for it. Colin, obviously, I'd worked with on Insurrection. He was ready to take a break at that point, and I very enthusiastically suggested that Phil might be a fantastic person to do it. I loved Phil's work since forever. I mean, I just love Phil's work. And once it was Phil and me working on it, I think the tone and atmosphere and type of story evolved again. I'm not suggesting that it's completely different stories to the sort of things that I was originally intending to do, but the real focus on character and, as it were, detail, both literal visual detail and just the detail of the community, the situation, the interaction of the characters, really grew up because it grew out of the fact that Phil and I were enjoying those were the things that we really wanted to do. And I have to say that it is, since day one, it's been one of my absolute all-time favourite things to work on. And Phil and I really enjoy discussing what we're going to do and executing it. And it's always an incredible pleasure to see the pages come in. So it was always intended to be a very strong follow up to Insurrection, if a tangential one. But really, collaborating with Phil has turned it into a I would say a very much better beast.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that working relationship, so that people can get an idea of where it's coming from and what form it takes. Phil, as the artist, describe a little bit about your input into the series.
Well, Dan and I, well, Dan calls me or gets in touch with me and says, you know, have you got any ideas? and I usually have, because I'm a frustrated writer, I think. And I give him a load of ideas, and then I leave him alone so that he can introduce those ideas or his own into the scripts. And then from the scripts, I then take the artwork, do the artwork, and try to make it flow as well as possible, really. It's one of the most collaborative relationships I've had for a long time. There was a time when writers would be more sort of open to things, but circumstances in the industry have changed somewhat, so that becomes less easy.
And as the artist on the series, there's so much detail in those panels. How much of that are you bringing to it, and how much has come out directly of the conversations with you and Dan?
It's kind of, I don't know, probably 50-50. I tend to like to work in a kind of relatively detailed way. But Dan gives me nice crowd scenes to draw every so often. I'm actually drawing one at the moment. I've never been someone who really likes to... I probably should learn how to cut corners and produce a kind of easy work, but I always sort of challenge myself if I can. And to be truthful, I mean, this book is like, I'm getting to an age now where really, this is kind of like this is going to be hopefully my major work of my life. So, you know, I hope it stays going. Otherwise, I'm going to look very foolish saying that. I really sort of like, you know, I want to put everything into it, and I enjoy putting everything into it. So you know, that's how I work. I've never been one for really being able to, you know, bodge it out as quickly as possible.
Out of interest, how much did you draw on what Colin had done with Insurrection? Because obviously these take place in the same universe.
Yeah, I kind of used Colin's, well, the cat design is obviously Colin's. I modified it slightly and made it slightly smaller, so that it was a bit more like a one man craft. But I have referred back to Colin where it's necessary, because Colin's such a good designer. But in the main, it's sort of like I've had fun designing stuff. And, you know, I mean, from the shuttle at the beginning, in the first episode onwards, it's just been good fun to design stuff.
I mean, this is your sort of major work for 2000 AD. Was working for the magazine, certainly. Was 2000 AD an influence on you? Is it something you've always wanted to work for?
I have worked for them before, and I did work for back in the IPC days. But you know, I was in the first issue of Revolver for some reason, and I started my career there. But I kind of moved to the States, not literally, but you know, just work wise. I think there's an awful lot of influences from that early period of 2000 AD, from up to around 1990, I suppose, 91. Yeah. But I think what really is the casting influence is what 2000 AD does really well, which is stories that the Americans tend not to be. It tends not to be seen as commercial in America. So, but it used to, you know, they used to be a time when they were looking for more off the wall, more quirky and more elaborate types of storytelling. And, you know, and that's something the 2000s always had in spades. I mean, whether it's been Mike McMahon or Brian Bolland or Kev O'Neill, and also the sort of massive stories of John and Alan and Pat, these massive sort of, you know, like just these huge stories where you actually get a chance to actually get really involved with the characters, and there's the quirky ideas and the satire and the everything about that thing, which I think is now seen as peculiarly English or British because of the British invasion in the 90s.
And I mean, Dan, you've been working for us for many years now. To have had such a career at 2000 AD, and to be relatively, you'd not done loads of Dreadworld stuff, but then to come up with two series such as Insurrection and Lawless, have you found it fun to be diving into this world, to find a fresh angle, to find something new?
Yes, absolutely. I think the very first thing I've now written for 2000 AD for longer than 2000 AD was running when I was reading it, which was a very weird experience. And I think the very first things I ever wrote for 2000 AD, sort of on spec, my first sort of jobs were two Judge Dredd stories that Ron Smith drew.
Yeah.
And then sort of essentially went and did other things, not Dread related, mainly because I considered John Wagner in particular to be such a superb architect of the Dread universe that you know, how could you impose yourself and do any better? But working on the magazine, because it's the magazine and because it's the Dread magazine, it was a case of, can we do something that's Dread universe related without actually walking on the toes of John Wagner, dealing with Dredd himself, dealing with Mega City One, which is why Insurrection was really a deliberate attempt to do something very, very different indeed. And many people seem to love it. I know a lot of Dredd purists are going, well, how does this work in terms of the universe? How does it fit and all that kind of stuff? I think it fits if you let it. And, and it was trying to tell a story that kind of utilized the both literally and metaphorically the machinery of the Dredd universe, but extrapolated it into a sort of space opera setting and reversed the polarity of making the Dredd universe as fascistic and unpleasant as it undoubtedly really is, except we always see it from the point of view of the protagonist. And I thought it'd be just fun for a change to do something that was bleakly the other way around. And Lawless is its absolutely its own self. I mean, I think, as I say, particularly once Phil was involved, we've made it its own thing very much. It's not in any way a sequel or a continuation, but it sort of came from the same place in as much as the things that I was playing with in Insurrection grew into it. And again, by putting it on a different world to create a essentially a judge character who is dramatically different in outlook to Dredd and the conventional judge, but yet you can see the sort of same coding of training, I suppose, and belief in the system and that kind of stuff, but just interpreted in a different way. I think it means that it is expanding that universe. It's something where you can see elements of the Judge Dredd universe in terms of the uniforms and the weapons, but it is trying to explore different parts of it. And going back to what Phil was saying just now, I think he's doing himself a disservice. When we do have long discussions, I always, whenever possible, think it's a great idea to talk to the person who's going to be drawing the script and therefore doing all the heavy lifting and find out the things that they want to draw and they want to visually, because I think an artist is going to be more excited and as it were bear greater fruit if they're doing something they're terribly enthusiastic about. Mm-hmm. So Phil and I talk about those sorts of things. I say, what sort of things would you like to do? And Phil's been great with the collaborative effort. As he said, it is rare these days to have that sort of thing where we can swap ideas back and forth and he'll give me ideas. He'll often just send me a sketch of a character and said, I've thought of this character. Can we get them in somewhere? Because I think he's interesting. And often we do. And it may not be exactly the way Phil suggested it, but we find ways of making them fit. And what I write is full script. So it has, and the sort of detail that I go into is detailed in terms of I guess panel composition and stuff like that. Not because I expect Phil to follow that literally. He knows how to lay out a page much better than I do. But just to try and communicate to him how I'm imagining it in my head, so that he can then do a better version. And obviously, I will specifically describe the detailed elements of anything that is very specific. If it's a specific building or a specific prop, I will say, "Well, I'm imagining something like this." But the actual texture, the visual, amazing visual texture of Lawless is what Phil is doing. You know, he says to crowd scenes, well, I'll say, you know, the townsfolk gather. You know, 3 weeks later, he's drawn the town and there are people in it that I couldn't possibly have imagined. And the more we do, the more of his art that I see, you know, sort of obviously I'm scripting ahead of him, but the more I see stuff, I'll see a character or a device or a vehicle or something like that and go, I like that. What's that? We don't really necessarily know. So we will make it something. Do you see what I mean? So so that kind of, and this is a very derogatory way of putting it, but that kind of set dressing design that Phil is doing is getting woven back in as I see something. I think, oh, that's cool. Let's use that some more, and we can build it up that way. And I think, in a really fundamental way, the actual characters themselves, although I imagined them having story arcs and character arcs, but that they have become more and more important. Pettifer is probably the best example. She was just going to be the supporting character, you know, a sounding board. Once I saw what Pettifer looked like, I wanted to do so much more with that character. And some of the stories we're doing now, we're deepening the roles of characters who've been around for quite a long time as you know, a named character who pops up in the background, but we're seeing them again and we're adding new things to them. So there's the sort of core of story, but it is getting elaborated and developed and deepened every time we do a bit more of it. The potential gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Mm. You mentioned Pettifer there, and that sort of nicely brings me on to something I was going to talk about, which is there's an ongoing debate in comics about the portrayal of women and the way that women are various different body types are shown, the way that they're presented in stories, the way that female characters are treated by comics. And Lawson is very much the standard kind of Amazonian style. Go on.
I would like to make a slight addendum to that.
Yeah, sure. Go on.
Because I made her... Because if you actually look at female superhero characters, they basically... they have huge breasts and very, very slim hips. And if you actually notice, Lawson's got quite good childbearing hips. And that was purposeful because I wanted her to be a country girl. I wanted her to be a horse rider.
Mm.
So even at the very beginning, I was thinking very seriously about that side of things. So,
well, I mean, my question was going to be about how you guys have used the way that the look of characters as a point of character. You know, it's not just here's the stock shape of a character that you would expect in this situation. These body types, these people, whether they're male, female, uplifts, robots, whatever, are part of the telling of the story.
Yeah.
They definitely are. But the thing is, I think you said it there, they're people. They're all people.
Yeah.
I think it's lovely that we've got a strip that is you know, popular and being enjoyed, that is incredibly female centric in its main major characters, and that those characters have a friendship and a relationship that is very clearly delineated. The actual arc of Pettifer, where she goes from being essentially sort of comic relief in the early stories to getting sort of metal in an unusual way, I think is good. But whilst I'm aware that I'm writing and Phil's drawing a strip that's got strong female characters in it, I don't sit down in the morning when I go to do the next episode and go, oh, I must write strong female characters. I'm going to write strong characters, because this is a story. Mm. This is a story about people, and I think the consequence of doing that means that all the characters, and in this case you're mentioning particularly the female characters, I hope are well represented and are considered to be good characters. And that's, if everybody did that, nobody would have to sort of proactively sit down and go, I must do a strong female character led story, or I must do a whatever. You know what I mean? It's you. If you get the story right and you populate it with interesting characters, then you're going to represent them reasonably well, rather than setting out to try and do that in a kind of deliberate and therefore forced way.
I think it can be a bit counterproductive as well if you start fighting against stereotypes. If you set out to fight against stereotypes, you end up in a position where you can't have someone as a bad guy, because, you know, or you can't do this with them, or you can't, and so you end up leaving them alone and just not using them.
Yeah.
And I think that's a real problem. That's a real problem in the industry, is that, you know, characters automatically have to be role models. And that means that you maybe can't do the sort of interesting things, like a character like Wolverine, who is a villain as well as a hero, or even Dredd, who's, you know, there's an ambiguity to the morality of Dredd in a way. If you start telling yourself, oh, I've got to do characters like this, and I can't show, you know, it just becomes confusing. And also with strong, if you're talking about strong female characters, I was brought up by a very strong woman who, you know, did a lot of great, who went to night school to learn how to do a job so she could better provide for me in a time when single parent families were, you know, I had dinner ladies going, oh, shame. And she was strong and she fought, but she's not strong in the male sense of strong. And I think that's something that, you know, you don't want to impose ideas that women have to be strong in a male way, because that's just as bad as if they were, you know, as if you were just drawing them as cliches.
Well, I think that's one of the interesting things about Lawless is that, ultimately the judge system is, regardless of, you know, how many female judges there are, it is nonetheless very much a kind of male power fantasy, you know, that kind of totalitarian nightmare. And so having characters within that who don't necessarily conform to that way of being. I mean, Meta is a classic example of somebody who doesn't necessarily believe or adhere to the big lie, you know, the big theological fundamental totalitarianism of Dredd's world. And it kind of helps that she is out in the sticks where perhaps the rules are a little bit more blurred than they would normally be.
It's hidden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also I said this before, but the logic of the mega city cannot be the same logic as a colony, because you can't, you know, the mega city is overpopulated. You have people to spare. You can't, you know, you can shoot a doctor and it won't matter. But in a community, you can't do that. Mm. In a small community, you have to have a more balanced approach to judgment.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely it. With Lawson, we definitely see her behaving in what you might regard as sort of typical judge fashion, in being the instant arbiter of problems, and often a violent solution to those problems. But there is a sort of frontier justice to it, and she's incredibly pragmatic about those things, because she just realizes that they, you know, there's a bigger picture than just someone's committed a crime. The penalty is this. I will execute that. You know, there is. And I think that's why, you know, she's a marshal rather than a judge. I think that vague distinction, I think, is meant to impart that. And again, with Pettifer, Pettifer's, you know, sort of look and behaviour, her timidness and everything like that, sort of explained away early on by the idea that she's you know, she is the product of the Justice Department, but she's, you know, very clerical. She's on the sort of technical side of things. But when push comes to shove, even though she is unused to it because she's got no practical experience, she has got that training too. And in fact, her moments of actual heroism, what Phil was saying about female characters not behaving strongly, but not in a male strong sense. Mm. When she sort of reaches that point where she has to do that, has to be the judge, I sort of get a genuine rush out of realizing that it seems completely. To me, it seems completely believable that she could do that. She just doesn't want to or particularly like to, but she can do it. And when she does it, she can do it with the same sort of determination, because she's got that sort of that training behind her. I think it's the last few episodes that have been published where she is essentially taking on the martial role. I think it shows her gathering strength in a way that is entirely suitable to her, but would not be suitable if it had been a story about the male deputy having to do that. And I like that. And it wasn't that I sat down and went, how can we do this differently? It sort of
grew.
It grew, because that's the way I could see that's what Pettifer would go through. That's what would happen to her. That's what she would do. And there is a sort of, I think that moment of heroism when she gets the, you know, says Marshal Pettifer moment, it was a tremendous, that's a tremendously exciting thing, because it sort of shouldn't be. It almost should have been pastiche or sort of a comedy take on those heroic comic moments. Mm. Yet it wasn't. It was entirely straight faced, and I thought was stronger as a result of it. And I think that's with all the characters, as Phil's saying, if you let them be them, they sort of show you what the what sort of story they're going to best suit and how to best get to the places that you've decided in your plot are the big beats.
I just, on top of that, I mean, the thing about Pettifer is that actually she probably needs more strength.
Yes.
To stand up to people, because you know, than Lawson does because of the persona, but both characters are highly nurturing characters as well. Even Meta is, I mean, she's nurturing around the people that she's around. She's trying to nurture the town. She's trying to keep that town alive and going and protected from outside influences. And I think that's, you know, something you don't necessarily see in a lot of characters.
And in terms of what Dan was just saying about you know, that the characters show you the way, I suppose after a while you do get that... thing that an awful lot of writers and authors talk about, which is where the characters almost become so real that they start making their own decisions.
Yeah. And I thought that was rubbish. I honestly did. I mean, I have been doing, I'm writing novels and comics for a long time, and that you, I certainly know that when I'm, you know, sort of when things are going well and I'm writing furiously, I can get sort of, my wife calls it the zone. I sort of go into the zone and I'm sort of channeling. I'm not sort of consciously creating. I'm just writing. And it's a weird experience. I'm sure other writers and indeed artists experience that. But it is definitely, there is a sort of direct state where the creation is just happening without you consciously deciding it's going to happen. And I thought that's what people meant by it. It's actually quite a few years ago now, though. I was writing a novel which I lost in its entirety. The computer died and took 80,000 words. Oof. And I had to write it. The only way around it was to write it again. And I did, I think, and I had a month to do it. And I rewrote the novel in a month. The reason I'm telling you this story is there was no time to think. And I was sure that the second version of the novel would be a very poor copy, a sort of faded photocopy of my memory of the original novel. But in fact, it was much better. And one of the reasons it was much better was the writing it the first time, even though I'd lost it, was sort of like a rehearsal, a dress rehearsal. And I was just writing it again. And as I was writing it, because there was no time to stop, there was almost no time to stop and correct typos. I had to get it down. And in the second version of the novel, a character appeared who I hadn't planned for them to be there. They weren't in the original version. These characters popped into a scene. And I remember thinking at the time as I was writing, what are you doing here? Oh, I haven't got time to write you out. I'll leave you there. That character then ended up having a really pivotal role to play in that novel. Mm. And it was a series of novels that I've been writing since. Became one of the most popular characters in the series and determined the plot for the next three novels. And I did not at any point consciously plan any of that. Mm. It was like this character had invited himself into the story and said, no, I like it here, I'm staying, and then proceeded to take control. And at that point, I suddenly realised that kind of bullshit thing about characters writing themselves actually does have some semblance of reality. And it was very weird. And having experienced it once, that's the most dramatic example of it. But I do know that and Pettifer is another good example in a milder way, where I sort of start writing and Pettifer knows where she's going, or Pettifer's story knows where it's going, because there are certain things that she would do and certain things she wouldn't do. Mm. And you know, I could sort of plot something out and look at it and then go, well, she'd never do that. That might make a good story. She'd never do that. What can I do? I think they really do determine you absolutely know what people are capable of and what they aren't, and you sort of adjust the story accordingly to make the most of those things. And if a character's got, say, a deep secret that only you as the writer knows because it's not being revealed in the story, or you really want to shock people by making somebody do something out of character, that's when you're sort of forcing that character into a different place, really, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And that can be fun, and that can either work tremendously well because it's genuinely meant to be a shock, or work disastrously because it's not meant to be a shock. You've just been clumsy about it, and you've pushed someone into a role they just wouldn't play, and it doesn't feel right for them to play.
One thing I'm curious about is the decision to make the strip black and white rather than color, because in recent memory, we've had two kind of Western influenced series, which was Lawless and The Grievous Journey of Ichabod Azrael and The Dead Left in His Wake by Rob Williams and Dom Reardon, which was also in black and white, but with some spot colour by Peter Doherty. It really strikes me that the Western stories are told very, very well in black and white.
I think they do. It's because they didn't have colour back then. If you look at any of the photographs, they obviously it was a colour. I think, to be perfectly honest, I think Lawless was black and white simply because it was the magazine, and that was the black and white slot in the magazine that we were going to fill. Mm. And I use the word fill advisedly, of course, because have you seen Phil Winslow's artwork? what it doesn't need colour. It's so beautiful. The detailing, the sort of. Just the line work is so beautiful that I think colour would be a crime. I think it's one of those things. I think of other you know, think of other great classic. You wouldn't want to colour Will Eisner doing The Spirit. You wouldn't want to colour John Buscema and Alfredo Alcala doing Conan, because that's the way it's meant to look. And I think Phil's done it to look that way. And it's got all the light and shade and contrast and everything you need. You don't need the support of, I mean, obviously great colour in comics is a wonderful thing, but it's rare these days, because I think people just, you know, it's like people don't necessarily, you know, when you make a black and white movie these days, people think, oh, you've made an art movie. Mm-hmm. You know, if you take black and white photographs, it's because you're being pretentious. You know, because the norm is to use colour in that way, and colour is extremely effective. But I think this is, you know, I think one of the worst things that could possibly be happen if Lawless was republished in an American format and someone coloured it, it just would be terrible. And I actually think this is going to sound strange, and I've got no evidence to back it up, but I think I actually even write it in black and white. I think in as much as I having seen episodes of it now, obviously, I know what it's going to look like and feel like. So I think I write it in my head. I'm imagining what I'm describing rendered in Phil's black and white style, and therefore don't do anything that would require anything else. I think a great example of what I'm talking about is not so much the density of the sort of beautiful cross-hatch line work and the sort of the detailed density that he does all the way through the strip, but actually the episode where Lawson rides out into the Badlands and it's baking hot and there's just miles of flatness and everything like that. And you know, if in color, that would be, you know, washed out yellows and bleached colors, and it would look amazing, but it looks even more amazing because Phil's let so much of the white come through to the point where we're blinded by the pages. And I think that's so much more effective. I think any, you know, even that you take the greatest colorist in the world, that would have somehow diminished that feeling of such extraordinary heat and vastness that you can't quite see it properly. I think that's an amazing episode for that reason.
Phil, any comment?
Yeah, I took this job because it was black and white.
Right.
Because Alfred Hitchcock was once asked why his colours were very muted, because he originally was a black and white film director, and then he went into colour, but it's very muted colour, except for occasionally he might punctuate something with some extra colour. And he said, you don't use all your tools in the toolbox at the same time, otherwise you're just everything's fighting against each other. Mm-hmm. And I think colouring, and I don't think it's necessarily colourists' fault. I think it's sometimes editorial. It's sometimes just about the technology. But I think it can really undermine line work. In the old days, you'd have line work and then you'd have like flat colour, or you'd have what used to be called blue line colour, like the European books, and that was like watercolours. And that was line and wash. And line and wash has been around for, you know, for 200, 300 years. Mm. And that kind of really suits line work. But I find colouring, especially computer colouring, undermines line work. Every bit of cross-hatching becomes irrelevant because it gets drowned under a big block of tone. And everything gets everything becomes blockier and simpler, and you know, the drawing is lost sometimes quite severely. It's not true of everything, and there's some really, you know, but if you think about the colorists that are really, you know, out there getting good reviews and seen as master colorists, they're actually not the colorists who are coloring in that very loud, gaudy style. They're actually coloring relatively flat. I mean, you know, Elizabeth Breitweiser, Geordie Belair, Matt Hollingsworth, they know color. And they let the line work breathe, whereas, you know, the temptation with computer coloring is to make it look like a painting, and to be honest, it never does. And it's I've actually colored, I actually painted someone else's work a long time ago, and I realized that things that work in line don't necessarily, even proportions don't work when you paint them. It throws things off, and you have to correct and change the drawing. And I think that's, you know, a major thing. I also think that the nice thing for me as an artist is that it is just me. It's just me making the decisions. It's from my hand to the viewer's eye. And I like that. I like the fact that it can, it's that direct communication, and it's really simple, and it goes back to cave painting almost. Anyway, that's me being pompous.
What we're saying, Mike, basically, is we've done a black and white arty wank feminist story, yeah, and got away with it. That's what we're saying.
And it's got a train chase in it. Let's not forget the action.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, as I said, we're coming up to sort of the double length finale of this series. Meta Lawson is still a character with lots of secrets.
Yes.
I'm assuming that there are plans beyond this moment as to, you know, what's going to happen to her and Pettifer and the other members of the community of Bad Rock.
We right from the word go, Phil and I hope this story would continue, and that we sort of write it in blocks of sort of 8 or 9 episodes, and then take a breather and then do another block or whatever. Mm. And certainly once we got to the end of what we now consider to be book one, the first 9 episodes, and Matt said, or should I say Tharg said, yes, you can, you know, by all means, let's go, let's do some more, this is fantastic. The stories that are being published, as you say, we're actually getting the huge luxury of a double length episode, which we have used the hell out of in the next. I mean, it's like, it's not just twice as many pages. We went, what can we do that's just, will warrant that and will be ridiculously huge and spectacular, which is, you know, it is that, you know, in a very special episode of Lawless. That will be the next one. And then there is a sort of finale single part, regular part epilogue at the end of that. But we are now already working on what is book 3. And in fact, when Matt said, let's go for book 3, we boldly went, okay, well, this is book 3, but book 4 will be this. And, you know, we suddenly had the confidence to plot ahead. So I think that's why the characters are becoming more and more, I suppose, dynamic in their interactions, because I know that we know there is now space for those things to pay off very effectively. You know, set up an interesting secret with, as you say, Lawson, for instance, thinking how long can we keep that going before we either bore people or the strip ends and we never get to tell the end of it or whatever. But now we can pace those things and deliver them properly. So some of those things to do with her, and also very strong character arcs to do with the other characters. It's gone from being, you know, Lawson as the hero with some people around her to more of an ensemble with Killer Man and Rondo and Pettifer and a few other characters. They have things going on in them. And obviously, at the same time, the danger and crisis that the characters are facing in Bad Rock is amping up. We're reaching something of a crescendo at the moment, but the stakes are going to be high, and that changes the perspective of the way the story works, so that you can then build the suspense rather than having, you know, an episode of the week. Some of those things we've been doing from the word go are now, both in terms of character and overall story, are beginning to pay off and either allowing us to finish them or to take them to the next stage. So yes, hold tight, because this double length episode is quite literally a runaway train, and it sets up and the implications of it, I think, sets up stupendously for what we're going to come back and do after that. And I have to just also mention, I think it's worth mentioning, with the double length episode, because it's very action orientated, very big cathartic, everybody fighting everybody's type story. It's the first time since we started that, although I scripted it, I let Phil choreograph. I just said to Phil, "Yeah, choreograph this. Do you know? Here's the action. Give me the action, and then I'll dial you back." So it's the first time so far where, although Phil will adjust and moderate and alter and maybe add in a panel, take a panel out before, and that's absolutely fine because that's the way we work. With this one, it really was a case of this is something that Phil wanted to draw, and I went, right, we need the following things to happen. Go for it. And then when I got the artwork in, I then went back and took my sort of sketched dialogue and rewrote and restructured in a very sort of American Marvel way the dialogue to fit the pages as they actually appeared. So this is one where the kind of panel for panel choreography, the action, the fight sequences is really driven as it should be by the artist who is depicting it. I think that's one of the great things about. There's that whole argument about whether full script is better than the Marvel method or whatever. I think the true answer to that is you should actually be able to switch between those two things in a good comic, where you know, if it is conversational or it is doing something where the writer is, as it were, leading the way, then do it full script. If it's switching the other way into all-out action, let the or something similar to action, let the artist choreograph that and let the writer pick up the pieces rather than forcing the artist always to fit to what the writer is doing. So hopefully people will really enjoy this. Like I said, it's not literally a roller coaster ride. not a roller coaster ride, but I think people will really enjoy it. And I think there is a sense of a story sort of in the best sense, running out of control and everything happening at once. And a final thing I would say, when I've said to Phil, you know, on this page of the action, I see this happening and this happening, this happening, expecting to get a page back that's got 3-4 panels. And he gives me a page where I've got, what was it, 20 panels in the first half of the, I don't know. Yeah, it's like, wow, you broke that down. And it works brilliantly because it is the alteration of the rhythm and pace of the story. You know, big stuff is big and takes a lot of space, but the small, fast stuff has got that thing, and some of the things I was going, I almost don't want to put balloons over that. It's so beautiful, the density of it. But there is in the best sense an incredibly high panel count in places that I couldn't possibly have conceived as a writer sitting here, because it would have been, you know, any artist given that script would have gone, what the hell is this guy on? Why is he asking for, you know, 16 yeah. in the top half of the page? But that's why you let the artist make those decisions.
See, for, yeah. it sounds like you've given yourself a lot of extra work there.
Oh, me?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I really, it's something that I really enjoy. I mean, I enjoy that kind of working out the pacing of a story like that and just sort of, we've done it before. I've done it, I've played with the ideas before and there is something very, a plot-based comic visually can usually it can read smoother. I mean, sometimes it can't. It just depends on, you know, how used to the artist. But I've worked on every kind. I've worked on. I worked with a writer of films who would just give me a shooting script, which was basically the dialogue with a couple of stage directions and nothing else, and I'd have to break down the action page by page and do like that. And I've also had a script which was a 2-hour phone conversation where the writer didn't actually tell me he was telling me the script until halfway through, when he said, I hope you're taking notes because this is the script. I think sometimes it's really enjoyable to, especially when it's something very visual, to be able to to play with action in that respect. You know, it is a lost art, the choreography of the fight scene. And I think to a large extent, it's very unfair to expect a writer to actually be able to think and translate that to an artist. So, you know, there you go.
I should point out that I am actually a very conventional, much more conventional writer than the writers that Phil's just mentioned, because as far as, you know, I just do very, very simply, I write them in Tippex on doilies, roll the doilies up, stick them in chest tubes and post them to Phil. And that seems to work really, really well.
Yeah, and the silver paper's really working now.
Yeah, I think it is, yeah.
Yeah, so, but you know, the thing about that sort of the way that Dan collaborates is basically going to enhance the script in every way, and I mean, you know, we both have ideas, we both sort of, like, you know, come to, so they're not really compromises, they're interpretations of those ideas, and then we move on. I have to say, if a writer actually presented me with a page which had 14 panels on it or 15 panels, I would probably refuse to draw it, or I would change it. But it's okay when you're doing it on your own, and you've kind of been given license to do it, and you can play around with it. And you know, the story, the way I've visually broken the story down, hopefully means that you spend a lot of time on the first few pages, and then you're at break and it's to mirror the idea of the train, that, you know, you're going at breakneck speed by the end of it, and that, you know, you're building up and building up. The worst thing an artist could do from a storytelling point of view is do something that flicks the reader out of the story. Yeah, so you know, it's a lot of it's kind of, you know, things that you see in the corner of the panel that are then used later on or whatever. But there's nothing worse than sort of like you're in a story and it's paced really well, and then suddenly something doesn't work. It's just like a panel doesn't work, or you're sort of like and I'm hoping that's kind of not what you know, that essentially it's a case of you read it and before you know it, you've finished it.
Yeah, it feels absolutely right. I think both the worst thing either an artist or a writer or both of them working in collaboration can do is remind the reader they're reading a comic. Because it's like, actually similar to what I was saying about earlier on about being writing when you get in the zone and you're not deliberately consciously doing it. You know, you want that spell within the first panel or two of a strip. You want the reader to be under that spell where they forget what they're doing. They're just lost in the story, and the storytelling is carrying them along so effectively that they don't think, oh, this is a lovely comic or whatever. They're in it in the same way they're immersed in a movie or a good novel. And so that you've got to watch for those sorts of things, and therefore, but if they are immersed, altering that rhythm, you know, lots of small fast panels because things are getting small and fast, will just come naturally, and will increase the rate of the reading flow and all that kind of stuff. So the actual rhythm of the panels actually works in terms of the way the story is driven. I think this is a really good example of that, because it's because it does get so tense and breakneck towards the end.
And that's all we've got time for on this episode of the 2080 Thrillcast Earthlets. Thank you very much indeed to you, our listeners, for tuning in, and also to Matt and Phil and Dan for being so generous with their time. And if this episode hasn't sated your appetite, then be sure to check out our YouTube channel at www.youtube.com/2000AD online, where you can find the 2000AD ABC, which continues its weekly bite-sized videos about classic 2000AD series. This week's is Mark Miller and Chris Weston's Cannon Fodder, which is wonderfully irreverent and bizarre and wonderful. So make sure you check that out. Every Monday we upload a new video and hopefully bring back some memories, introduce you to some series you may not necessarily know, and you get to see my ugly mug plastered all over your screen. So, you know, I'm not just a pretty voice. Not even a pretty voice. But thanks again to all our guests this week, and thank you to you, our listeners. Be sure to leave some feedback, and please, if you listen to us on iTunes, do go and leave us a star rating and a comment with some feedback. It's a great way for us to introduce new people to the Thrillcast and spread the word of 2000 AD. Let's face it, it's still the galaxy's greatest comic. It's only going to get better. Splundig Verthrig, Earthlitz. Now, are you reading the galaxy's greatest comic? 2000 AD is in orbit every Wednesday from all good news agents and comic book stores. 2000 AD is also available digitally. You can get PDF copies, which are DRM-free, from our website at www.2000adonline.com, or you can download the free 2000 AD app for Apple and Android devices. Now, you get that by searching for 2000 space AD in iTunes and the Google Play Store. There's also the Judge Dredd magazine, which is published in print and digital every month with more pages, more Dredd-centric stories, special features, and a bagged reprint magazine featuring forgotten 2000 AD classics. And don't forget that our graphic novels, including absolute timeless classics like Strontium Dog, Ace Trucking, Flesh, Judge Dredd, Slain, Robo Hunter, and many, many more, are also available digitally through our webshop and app. We're on social media with the latest announcements, competitions and freebies. Search on Facebook and Google Plus for 2000 AD. If you're on Instagram, we're Insta 2000AD, and you can follow us on Twitter, where we are at 2000AD. Make sure you stay Zarjaz, Earthlitz. Splundig Verthrig.